Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about sort of symbolic execution, and this was kind of originally we're looking at it as a kind of extending our coverage guided testing idea, where rather than trying to guess ways of running different code, we can just actually look at what the code is doing and try to solve for how do we get down a particular path. And also, when we're just running the code normally, rather than trying to figure out how to get, certain outputs, we can just kind of symbolically figure out what those outputs are supposed to be as like an algebraic expression and solve for that. And we saw kind of one big application for this is kind of bug finding or test case generation, that if we want to check all the code paths, we can kind of do that with symbolic execution. And we saw kind of this other application, that this is kind of a program analysis or reverse engineering tool, where if we want to look at a function, figure out how do I get to this part of a function, symbolic execution can potentially do that sort of thing. Or for like exploit generation, if we know there's an overwrite of the program counter, but we don't want to figure out where in the input does that come from, well, symbolic execution's doing the precise tracking to tell us that. And so one idea, which is kind of very researchy at this point, is that we can kind of automate all our exploit assignments by using symbolic execution to do the part of figuring out, what is the pointer here, where does it come from, and have some rules about, I want that to be a particular value in order to execute useful code, and just automate that. Now, we mentioned that there were kind of some big issues with symbolic execution. So one is kind of performance, that we end up with lots of paths that we're exploring and like way too many very easily, or very, very complicated sort of algebraic expressions. And this kind of prevents it from like actually working on very large programs. Now, even if we have a very large program, what we might be interested in is one function in that program, and symbolic execution is a better fit there. And there's lots of work on making these performance issues less often a problem, especially in kind of the bug finding based tools where we might be able to do some things that I sort of do anger can't do because it was working on machine code. We also saw that, for practicality, especially because of these performance issues, we might make some compromises for completeness. And we saw that anger makes a whole bunch of them. So anger was making a compromise in terms of how it dealt with writes to memory. If it didn't know the address, it just chose a possible one, rather than, by default, not analyzing all the possibilities. So that's too much. We saw that they have these kind of summaries of standard library functions rather than simulating them, because something like a memcopy gets really complicated if you actually try to simulate the machine code and deal with what if the length is every possible value. So they did a summary that kind of approximates it a little bit. It's going to miss some details in order to make the performance in the default case when you enable those sorts of summaries be a lot better. Questions on things we covered last time? Okay, so I can do any assignment Q&A people have. I didn't see anyone asking about the assignment during office hours, so I assume it wasn't too hard. Yeah?
I have just a quick question about what's the advantage of using RC and RepCell versus like ARC and RW?
What's the advantage of RC and RepCell versus ARC and RWLock? So this is asking RC RepCell versus ARC RWLock. And I didn't talk that much about RWLock, but basically this is sort of multiple. So RC, remember, was reference counting. And refcell was one modifier at a time. And one modify, It's one only write, well, no one else is reading. So only modify if no one else accessing. And RW lock and arc do the same thing. Why you're asking about comparing. The difference is that this is only single-threaded, and this is multiple threads. And your question is, why does Rust even bother providing the single-thread-only version? That's just a necessary restriction, it looks like. And I think the primary reason is that to make these work with multiple threads, we need to do extra synchronization. So if you took CSO2, you know about locks. We need to do something like locks. Probably not actually locks, but something like that, where we're going to use more expensive hardware operations to implement ARC and RW lock.
So it's just quicker to
do RC. So RC should be faster, at least on many systems. And indeed, some languages, as I mentioned, make a different compromise. So in C++, shared pointer, it basically ARC. There's nothing in the C++ standard library that's equivalent to RC, because they decided, it would be faster if we implemented the single-threaded only version of this, but that's not worth it. Questions, comments? And I guess something that we alluded to when we talked about Rust is that there's actually enforcement in the Rust language that you only use the single-threaded versions in a single thread, which something like C++ can't really do. And there's enforcement because basically you have to, when you pass things to threads, you have to mark them as safe to pass to threads, or they have to be marked by their whoever wrote the library that defines like the struct has to mark it that way. Okay, so other assignment Q&A or other last thing? Okay, so we mentioned last time, I should kind of show briefly our examples of kind of mentioning just symbolic execution in I/O. We mentioned this idea of like tracking things as arrays in memory, and this idea of summarizing functions. So that was Inger. And we had this example here, which I kind of went over very, very briefly. But the idea here is I'm doing symbolic execution, and Inger has unconstrained means that sort of the program counter or similar, has an unknown value. So basically, a common sort of automatic exploitation thing that people do with something like Inger is you run the program until the program counter has an unknown value, and then you see, well, is that unknown value based on the input? If so, that sure seems really useful. And this is kind of just an automated way of doing that. And there's some other things that, you can do to help out with exploits, kind of as an exploit generation tool that the symbolic execution gives you. So like one thing Inger enables is you can have a lookup table where as memory is modified in the symbolic execution, it remembers where did I put each thing that each variable you specified, each symbolic thing in memory, and you can do a reverse lookup. You can say, where is byte 54 of the input? Where is anything that depends on that in memory? And you can just find all those addresses. And also you can check how the registers relate to it. So remember when we talked about setting up ROP chains to happen from something that wasn't a return, we were like looking at, well, what register can we turn into the stack pointer or something like that? Well, this can tell you what gadgets do I want to look for based on what registers are set to something useful. We could do that by hand too, but this kind of can automate that process. And I know there's a buffer overflow here that overwrites like a function pointer. When that function's called, what are the arguments? You know, where do they come from? This seems like a tool where maybe it could help us try to automate answering that question, with the caveat that we need to get over all the performance and approximation issues in order for that to be more useful than kind of reverse engineering by hand by reading the assembly and or using a classic debugger before. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up symbolic execution. I'm going to talk about one other type of program analysis, and this is something that I believe in some versions of 3710, they've talked about static analysis tools. Is that true? Yeah. So I'm going to talk about kind of trying to do what we're trying to do, the sorts of things we talked about with symbolic execution, with static analysis, and kind of what is the static analysis actually doing for that kind of thing. And in talking about this, I want to think about kind of all our techniques as kind of navigating this trade-off. Whenever we're doing a program analysis, be it this coverage-guided fuzz testing or the symbolic execution, we're kind of trying to navigate being complete and sound. Like ideally, we find kind of all the examples of whatever problem we're looking for, like any sort of memory bug. And all the examples we find would be real bugs. And the techniques we've seen so far, like they're sound in that they always find real bugs, except that symbolic execution we mentioned, because we're doing these approximations, sometimes it finds fake bugs. If we do the version where we there's multiple possible addresses to write to, choose one of them, that sort of thing. Sometimes there might be multiple bugs. We might miss real bugs. And symbolic execution, if we actually go through the effort of solving all the paths exactly, is complete. So some place we haven't explored is, well, we can do things where, we'll do analyses that, maybe aren't always sound, which means they'll give us false positives, but will be more likely to be complete. We can navigate this trade-off in a more nuanced way when we're doing other types of program analysis that isn't trying to be exact in the same way. And also we can kind of get better performance. So we'll do different approximations. So one thing that we haven't been approximating is kind of tracking the values in the program. In all the techniques we've used so far, we've always tracked them exactly. But if like we're looking for use after free bugs, most of the values in the program don't really matter. And instead, we can kind of just track a summary that's going to be a lot faster to analyze. Another thing we've been mostly trying to do is look at exactly what paths through the code are possible. But if we're okay having some false positives, what we might do instead is track a deliberate superset of the possible paths. We'll have some things that are not possible, and that's fine because as long as it is not too often we find a bug on an impossible path, that's still going to be very useful. If it's too often, it's a problem. Or we could, if we cared about having fewer false positives, we can maybe track a subset of the possible paths. We could, deliberately do something that we might know might miss a few things. Like we might assume loops don't execute more than a certain number of times or something like that. And just say, I'm okay missing some cases in order to make this analysis tractable and get good results. And to give an example of what this sort of analysis might look like, let's say I want to check for use after free in this kind of style. And I'm going to try to model what my pointers look like, but rather than tracking all the pointer values and all that stuff like symbolic execution would do, I'm going to just say the pointer is allocated, freed, or, you know, that those are the states. And I'm just going to look at every use of the pointer and say, how does it change the state? So in a simple example, at point A here, the pointer quux is allocated. And I know passing it to free makes it freed. And at C, that's a use after free because we're using the pointer and it's in the freed state. And this is a kind of analysis we can do without actually looking at any of the code in the dot dot dots, which is a big problem with symbolic execution, that it was hard to avoid doing that. It's not impossible to imagine trying to do that with symbolic execution, but you know, this is something we'll avoid. And there are tools that do this. So like Clang scan build, at least at the time of these slides, like produce something like this. And note that this could be a false positive. Someone tell me how it could be a false positive? What approximation is Clang scan build making that might not be correct? Or alternately, what can you do to something around this code to make it so this bug never happens? No one seems to be coming up with it or thinks it's too much of a trick. And the answer has to do with what could we put in something unknown to make this bug never happen? Yeah. So you could reinitialize quux. So I like that idea. If we assume we're writing C code that doesn't deliberately access other things on the stack, that is a problem. That's not possible. There's something simpler we can do. Yeah, okay, so I will do my answer. There we go. Bug's impossible. Right, and that's an analysis something like symbolic execution would actually look for, you know, figure out, usually. And of course, this might be like conditional, but probably in this case, we would say like, if that happens, we don't care, we still want to tell the programmer about this issue. So where this gets more interesting is when we have sort of obviously conditional code paths like here. So here it's less obvious that this use after free bug is possible. And in fact, we can easily write a version of complex, that function, which makes it possible. And with symbolic execution, we probably try to solve for what complex does. And based on the name, you might think that's probably not a good idea. But we can kind of make our same graph here that, you know, one path through this code is that we could go from A to B, free quux, and go to D and do that. But something we can do in a more sophisticated stack analysis is we can kind of consider a summary of the paths through the code. And rather than considering each possible forking, we just need to consider what are the possible values of our state for a pointer. So I know if we go to B, then we're going to C or D with quux freed. We need to consider that case. And I know we alternately can skip B, in which case we go to C, and we know it's different because quux is allocated. And a consolidation we can do is we can say, it doesn't matter how we reach C. Here, except that except for what the state of flux is. And this means that if, for example, I have more conditionals, more examples of B, C, and D, I can kind of reuse that sort of path information. I don't have to like actually analyze all the possible paths here. And you can see that this is something that Ceiling Clang does this. And even in here, it goes through the steps we used to got there, but it's not actually like trying to simulate all the code or even prove that this is really possible. It just says, if this happens, that's use after free look. And we can make this kind of more tractable, even if we have lots of if statements, because we don't need to, when we're going to here, we just need to consider, are there ways of getting there with quarks freed or quarks allocated? We don't need to look at each of the paths. If there's like 10 different ways to get here, we only need to consider two possibilities, not 10. In order to find the bug, in order to print this message, we need to choose one of those possibilities. That's probably easier. Let's do a little trickier example here. So we're tracking states of pointers. What should the state be at C of pointer Q? And this is where we get to my analysis that seems so easy, now is really hard, if we think of implementing. Who would like some more time? Okay, who thinks A, it should be listed as allocated, B, freed, C, allocated if and only if reached via A1, D, freed if and only if reached via A1, E, something else? Okay, so we have consensus that we should like say there's two possible, that it can either be freed or allocated, and it's based on whether it's reached with A1. If we think of the bookkeeping we need to do this, clearly it's not good enough to just track allocated and freed for each pointer. We actually need to figure out what pointers point to the same things. And yep, this is something that Clang Scan Build does do. But now this makes this analysis way more complicated because we're not actually tracking for each pointer, whether it's allocated or freed. We're actually tracking what each pointer points to, and then tracking for each thing pointed to, whether it's allocated or free. So we need to do kind of a points to analysis, and kind of the kind of simple way of imagining doing this is that we'll keep track of a set of things something could point to, and track that set, and then we can kind of update what that set looks like. Something we can do to make this possibly, to avoid the state explosion problem, is that instead of having these two values here, we could just say C P points to P points to ID1 or ID2, and Q points to ID2. Right. We could just simplify it but got a more approximate answer. And that's commonly something you might do with this analysis if you, you know, didn't care about being sound all the time. But sometimes we're going to get a wrong answer because we aren't tracking all the details of what the values could be. Yeah, so we can do Hadamard selectors, or we could merge them together like so. So that's an option we have that we didn't have in like symbolic execution so easily to make this more tractable. So this is like a nice promising technique. I'd say, you know, a problem that we have kind of practically is that from a performance point of view, even for this, like this is much simpler than symbolic execution, way faster, but it's still a real challenge to do this kind of analysis across the whole program. And in fact, I showed you like Clang analyzer scan build, it works on a function by function basis. It doesn't analyze between functions by default because that's way very slow. And so often, like this is the kind of place where we'll have approximations, which will end up giving us kind of wrong answers all the time. Questions on static analysis? Oh, and the other thing to point out about doing this is like this is symbolic execution had a real problem with loops. With this technique, we can kind of simplify things a bit because we can say that when I get to E, how can I get to E? And once we can kind of figure out that we don't need to like figure out what the loop does like for arbitrary numbers of iterations, we just need to figure out when have things stopped changing as far as our states go when we execute the loop. So I can say, okay, well, if I go A, B, C, D, then I have a use after free here. If I go A, B, D, E, I have an OK access because the state was allocated. And if I get to D from allocated, that goes to something I already analyzed, so I don't need to redo that. So that's like a key nice thing we can do in this type of static analysis is that we have a clean solution for loops. Because we can usually say, oh, I already figured out what happens when we start executing the loop from the state. I don't need to worry about if the loop executes another time. I already did it. Good. And we just need to worry about kind of what the D case does. And in this case, we actually will find a different bug. Or we will find kind of that we wrap around to something we've, again, already analyzed. So this is something that's easy to do in static analysis, kind of easy to do, so that we can at least like actually figure out what happens in loops without running into a state explosion problem, because we can kind of say, oh, this is the same situation I already saw. In symbolic execution, we can't do that, because like the loop counter and all that stuff is part of our symbolic execution state. And you can see that Clang's analyzer like does this analysis. And finds both the double free bug and the use after free bug that way. So that's my brief mention of static analysis, and I'm mentioning it because you know, often it's a much more practical solution for things we might think of using symbolic execution for, even though it's kind of making this compromise that's going to give us probably false positives and false negative and or false negatives. And like symbolic execution, it still has performance problems. It's still hard to scale to a full program because of things like that points to analysis problem. You need to figure out can this pointer point to? In a big program, that's really complicated, and we're probably going to make some approximations. And I showed you like this kind of use after free sort of analysis. Static analysis tools are actually pretty bad at that, right? They can work in some simple cases, and they're getting better, and hopefully getting a lot better, but where they really shine is just common bug patterns. You know, we can look for things that are kind of very local, where we don't have to look at a lot of context. Like, gosh, if you're doing this and you have, you know, an object that comes from a SQL thing, that is bad. You shouldn't be doing that. You know, that's the best thing they're really good at looking for. But that's not so interesting from a design point of view, though it does, it is useful in that they'll consistently find these issues and quickly find these sorts of issues. So question, and this is on sort of static analysis, the complicated stuff, and I'm just showing the simple stuff, but this is what works all the time. Okay. Anyway, so our next topic I'm going to talk about, so we talked a bunch about program analysis. I'm going to go to a different side of things, which is I'm going to talk about sandboxing, talk about running programs that we know are probably unsafe in a way which is safe or safer. And I believe this is a concept that's covered in some form in every 3710, you know, in the idea that we have this principle of least privilege, right? That when we want, we really want to run a program where it can do as little as possible. And this is something that we violate all over the place on the modern desktop or laptop, right? I run a typical program, it can connect to anywhere, it can upload all my files to the internet, it can delete all my files, it can record all my keystrokes. And we really like to kind of apply this principle of least privilege to all software. But it's really a challenge to do this. And part of the challenge of doing this is let's think of what things like typical applications need. So I have two types of applications, which we probably think, you know, shouldn't be doing these things here. You know, probably not deleting all my files, recording my keystrokes. In the case of the browser, probably not making network connections to anywhere and uploading all my files to the internet and deleting all my files in the case of the word processor. But what do these applications need to be able to do? Someone tell me, what are some things you need to be able to do from my web browser or my word processor for them to run? Yeah.
Probably accept input.
So accept input, yeah. Got other things, yeah.
Modify files.
So that's probably very obvious in the word processor case because we need to open, save, and overwrite files. How about the web browser case? Who thinks we need the web browser needs to modify files? Thinks it does not. Okay, so we have a split. Someone want to argue for why web browser needs to modify files? Yeah. Okay, so installing extensions, search history, okay. Anything else, yeah?
The web browser needs to be able to accept files as well. Like say I want to upload a file to a website.
Versus so we'll get that later. So okay. Upload files. We'll get to that later. So going with modifying files, yeah? Save certificates, okay. Anything else? Okay, yeah, sorry.
I think like the web browser should also have access to utilize hardwares, like for example GPUs too.
Let's get to that later, but yeah. Let's just talk about modified files. Any other reasons the web browser needs to modify files? Then we'll get to all the other things that should need to be able to do. Yeah. Okay, cache for performance of websites. I'm surprised no one's brought up what I think is the most obvious way. Save link as. Maybe that's not modifying. Downloading files, question mark. Okay. So modifying files. So if I mention uploading files, something we want our web browser to do. So I'll just make this A. Accessing the GPU functionality to display things for web pages. Anything else we need? We probably want to talk about the network. Yeah. Okay, make network connections. Okay. And so I talked about web browser. How about things the web word processor needs to be able to do? So probably it also needs to be able to accept input and modify files. Anything else on this list probably needs or we should note? Yeah.
Print,
okay. And that probably is also something we want our web browser to do. And we can probably keep going. There's like, the to run these programs legitimately, they need a whole lot of access to the system. And the way I've phrased it so far, this is actually for you about. I just said they need to be able to modify files. I didn't say which files. And it might be reasonable to say that, you know, they should not be able to, like, upload my taxes, but how do we know that's versus something different than something they should be able to? Not easy. So we're going to talk about trying to apply kind of our principles of, you know, way multi-user OSs act, you know, that why I can't, you know, like, overwrite the OS. You know, permission denied, right? We have limited privileges. And the enforcement mechanism there is that the OS, when we ask to open a file, it's checking, does the current process, you know, is it running as a user who can do that? And so we're going to try to apply this idea to things like a web browser. So kind of the intuition is that the web browser should run as a different user. And that means if the web browser is insecure or is compromised, that it shouldn't be able to, you know, do anything bad. And talk about trying to make this idea work. But the biggest practical problem is all the functionality I told you, a lot of it kind of requires running as our user. If I want to access my files, the web browser has to be running with my permissions to access files. So the strategy we'll actually use is something I'll call privilege separation, where we'll identify parts of the web browser that are dangerous, and we'll have those run as a separate user who won't have access to change random files on the system, just like I, as a normal user of Portal, don't have access to change bin OS. And to kind of give a simple example of this, let's say I want to show videos. And the video decoding library is tens of thousands of lines of code, including lots of handwritten assembly. And it might be insecure, and we don't have the time to check it. It's really hard to figure out if it's secure. But the video decoding library doesn't have the problems our browser had as far as all, or our word processor had, as far as all the things it needs to do. It needs to read a video file as input and output images. That's all it needs to do. It doesn't need to access other files. Doesn't need to modify files in the file system, doesn't need to open network connections. So that is something that's much easier to provide least privilege to. And we can extend our idea that like we can run things as a different user in like Portal and apply this here. So we can create a new user, start the video decoder as that user, and communicate it to it with, you know, something like its standard in and standard out. So on Unix, or probably also on Windows, we use something called pipes, which are kind of like a terminal, except they're, you know, programmatically used. You don't have to type into them. You can just have a program send into a pipe and receive from a pipe. Something like that. And so kind of our code would be that we'd, you know, have our video decoder. We'd write a separate program that changes its user to some user who has no privileges on the system and just runs the video decoder library. And since this program is running as a user with no privileges on the system, you know, if there's a bug in the video decoder library that's exploitable, the worst the attacker can do is send back weird images. They can't, like, overwrite, upload all my files to the internet. And to run this, you know, we're going to kind of get a file handle to communicate with this program. You know, send the video data, receive an image to display that image. So questions about this privilege separation idea? Okay, so any thoughts on who thinks there are, who can find any like security question marks with this design for doing privilege separation? So I'm writing them as a separate user. Which of these, let's go back to our list of things my word processor and web browser can do. What can that other user do? Well, the other user can accept input, but we want that. They can modify files that they own, but presumably that user doesn't own any files. They can upload files they can read. This is a little sketchy because on my laptop, do I mark all my files as only readable by users? I probably accidentally make some of them world readable. Oops. Can make network connections. I haven't stopped. Like, anyone who logs into Portal can make network connections from Portal. So this can make network connections. So this is a good start, but you know, it's not really a complete solution because even an unprivileged user on it, especially on like a single user, quote unquote, desktop or laptop, often has a lot of privileges that we don't want to give to actually like make this isolation effective. We can open network connections. We can also like use all the memory on the system and do all sorts of denial of service type things. Also, this is awkward to set up. So switching users is not something we just let any program do, typically. And if we imagine having lots of components we want to isolate, well, if two programs are running as the same user, one of those programs can debug the other. Because that's how the debugger works, right? Debuggers can debug other programs. Same thing works here. So to actually isolate them from each other, we need to have a separate user for each thing we're doing privilege separation for. And also, it's slower. We need to do kind of extra time. So I'm going to talk about ways of sort of fixing a bunch of these issues where we're going to take advantage of having some more help from the operating system. So our operating system is going to realize, your operating system author has basically realized, this separate user tool isn't really good enough to implement this type of privilege separation, so they have some extra tools for us to do that. And kind of the big tool we're going to have is that we're going to do system call filtering. So there's some other tools we're going to use. Probably the biggest one is system call filtering. That when a program asks the OS to do something, if you learn in CSO2, it makes a system call to do that. And therefore, if we can control what system calls a program is allowed to make, we can isolate it in a way that's kind of different from the user isolation and very much and limit operations that we can't limit by just setting the user, you know, like accessing the network, for example. And Linux has a very simple API for, oh, this is the wrong call. Sorry, that should be the call, the function call here should not be setconf, it should be PRCTL, program control. So this call, if you do it, that's a very simple system call filter. After you make this call, the only system call that program can make from then on is read, write, underscore xset, and sig return. Sig return's needed for some IPC reasons. Everything else, if the program tries to make the system call, it gets turned into kill this program. And read and write, you might say, well, that's not good. You can read and write things. You can read and write anything you already have open. If you don't already have it open, open's not on this list. Can't do it. So this is kind of simple support, which kind of gives us the same thing as running as a separate user, because these operations don't let the program do anything, any of those dangerous operations. Now, the problem is that this might be a bit too restrictive for what our program actually needs to do. It's probably enough for a video decoder, except that allocating memory isn't on this list. But that prevents the video decoder from using all our memory. Linux also supports more finer grained filtering, where you can write a program, like an actual program, that filters system calls, where basically every time there's a system call, this little program you wrote runs and says, is that system call allowed or not? And to give an example here, this is actually like a little machine language. And here I write I load the system call number into an accumulator, and I compare it to this constant syswrite. Is this a write system call? And if so, I jump ahead to here. Otherwise, I run the return kill process. If I jump ahead, I run return allow. So this is a filter that only allows the write system call. Everything else kills the process. And you can see I can kind of extend this to sort of, you know, filter on more attributes. There are fields besides the system call number, like its arguments that I can look at. So this lets me set a very flexible filter. But there's kind of some practical problems with this. So one issue is that if I think of a system call like open here, this is the information I'd have in BPF. And that what we really want to do is filter based on the file name probably, but we get a pointer. There's no way of reading the pointer in BPF. We're missing we need a lot of context to figure out what the file name means. Because there's, you know, let's say I'm opening dev keyboard here, and I wanted to filter based on that. Well, here's another way of opening dev keyboard. Here's another way of opening dev keyboard. Here's another way of opening dev keyboard. Right? It's actually really hard to write a system call filter that allows something very natural. I want you to be able to open particular files and not other files. And also, we can't read the pointer. So, but even if we could, like, it's kind of bad. Also, there's a whole bunch of different ways of opening a file. So that's kind of a challenge. We'll talk a bit about that next time, and we'll talk about some other mechanisms for isolating programs that do things, that let us do things that kind of just system call filtering can't do.